might come to such a point that you would be justified in coming here, even wholly against his will, even secretly. It depends on how close the danger is, the danger to us all, and to you personally. I thought the danger was right on top of us now, from the way Mrs. Denniston talked.
That is just the question, said the director with a smile. I am not allowed to be too prudent. I am not allowed to use desperate remedies until desperate diseases are really apparent. Otherwise we become just like our enemies, breaking all the rules whenever we imagine that it might possibly do some vague good to humanity in the remote future.
But will it do anyone any harm if I come here? Asked Jane. He did not directly answer this. Presently he spoke again. It looks as if you will have to go back, at least for the present. You will, no doubt, be seeing your husband again fairly soon. I think you must make at least one effort to detach him from the NICE.
But how can I, sir? Said Jane. What have I to say to him? He'd think it all nonsense. He wouldn't believe all that about an attack on the human race.
As soon as she had said it, she wondered, did that sound cunning? Then, more disconcertingly, was it cunning?
No, said the director, and you must not tell him. You must not mention me nor the company at all. We have put our lives in your hands. You must simply ask him to leave Belbury. You must put it on your own wishes. You are his wife.
Mark never takes any notice of what I say, answered Jane. She and Mark each thought that of the other.
Perhaps, said the director, you have never asked anything as you will be able to ask this. Do you not want to save him as well as yourself?
Jane ignored this question. Now that the threat of expulsion from the house was imminent, she felt a kind of desperation. Heedless of that inner commentator who had more than once during this conversation shown her her own words and wishes in such a novel light, she began speaking rapidly.
"Don't send me back," she said. "I am all alone at home with terrible dreams. It isn't as if Mark and I saw much of one another at the best of times. I'm so unhappy. He won't care whether I come here or not. He'd only laugh at it all if he knew." Is it fair that my whole life should be spoiled just because he's got mixed up with some horrible people? You don't think a woman is to have no life of her own just because she's married?
Are you unhappy now? Said the director. A dozen affirmatives died on Jane's lips as she looked up in answer to his question. Then suddenly, in a kind of deep calm, like the stillness at the center of a whirlpool, she saw the truth, and ceased at last to think how her words might make him think of her, and answered,
No.
But, she added after a short pause, it will be worse now if I go back.
Will it?
I don't know. No, I suppose not.
And for a little time Jane was hardly conscious of anything but peace and well-being, the comfort of her own body in the chair where she sat, and a sort of clear beauty in the colours and proportions of the room. But soon she began thinking to herself, This is the end. In a moment he will send for the Ironwood woman to take you away. It seemed to her that her fate depended on what she said in the next minute.
But is it really necessary? She began. I don't think I look on marriage quite as you do. It seems to me extraordinary that everything should hang on what Mark says, about something he doesn't understand.
Child, said the director, it is not a question of how you or I look on marriage, but how my masters look on it.
Someone said they were very old-fashioned, but
that was a joke. They are not old-fashioned, but they are very, very old.
They would never think of finding out first whether Mark and I believed in their ideas of marriage?
Well, no, said the director with a curious smile. No, quite definitely they wouldn't think of doing that.
And it would make no difference to them what a marriage was actually like, whether it was a success, whether the woman loved her husband?
Jane had not exactly intended to say this, much less to say it in the cheaply pathetic tone which, it now seemed to her, she had used. Hating herself and fearing the director's silence, she added, "But I suppose you will say I oughtn't to have told you that."
"My dear child," said the director, "you have been telling me that ever since your husband was mentioned."
"Does it make no difference?"
"I suppose," said the director, "it would depend on how he lost your love."
Jane was silent. Though she could not tell the director the truth, and indeed did not know it herself, yet when she tried to explore her inarticulate grievance against Mark, A novel sense of her own injustice, and even of pity for her husband, arose in her mind. And her heart sank, for now it seemed to her that this conversation, to which she had vaguely looked for some sort of deliverance from all problems, was, in fact, involving her in new ones. "It was not his fault," she said at last. "I suppose our marriage was just a mistake." The director said nothing. What would the people you are talking of say about a case like that?" "I will tell you if you really want to know," said the director. "Please," said Jane reluctantly. "They would say," he answered, "that you do not fail in obedience through lack of love, but have lost love because you never attempted obedience." Something in Jane that would normally have reacted to such a remark with anger or laughter was banished to a remote distance, where she could still, but only just, hear its voice, by the fact that the word obedience, but certainly not obedience to Mark, came over her in that room and in that presence like a strange oriental perfume, perilous, seductive, and ambiguous. "Stop it," said the director sharply. Jane stared at him open-mouthed. There were a few moments of silence, during which the exotic fragrance faded away. "You were saying, my dear," resumed the director. "I thought love meant equality," she said, "and free companionship." "Ah, equality," said the director. "We must talk of that some other time. Yes, we must all be guarded by equal rights from one another's greed because we are fallen, just as we must all wear clothes for the same reason. But the naked body should be there underneath the clothes, ripening for the day when we shall need them no longer. Equality is not the deepest thing, you know." "I always thought that was just what it was. I thought it was in their souls that people were equal." "You were mistaken," said he gravely. "That is the last place where they are equal. Equality before the law, equality of incomes, that is very well. Equality guards life. It doesn't make it. It is medicine, not food. You might as well try to warm yourself with a blue book." "But surely in marriage—" "Worse and worse," said the director. "Courtship knows nothing of it, nor does fruition. What has free companionship to do with that? Those who are enjoying something or suffering something together are companions. Those who enjoy or suffer one another are not. Do you not know how bashful friendship is? Friends, comrades, do not look at each other. Friendship would be ashamed." "I thought—" said Jane, and stopped. "I see," said the director. "It is not your fault. They never warned you. No one has ever told you that obedience, humility, is an erotic necessity. You are putting equality just where it ought not to be. As to your coming here, that may admit of some doubt. For the present, I must send you back. You can come out and see us. In the meantime, talk to your husband, and I will talk to my authorities." "When will you be seeing them?" "They come to me when they please. But we've been talking too solemnly about obedience all this time. I'd like to show you some of its drolleries. You are not afraid of mice, are you?"
"Afraid of what?" said Jane in astonishment.
"Mice," said the director.
"No," said Jane in a puzzled voice.
The director struck a little bell beside his sofa, which was almost immediately answered by Mrs. Maggs. "I think," said the director, "I should like my lunch now, if you please." "They will give you lunch downstairs, Mrs. Studdock, something more substantial than mine. But if you will sit with me while I eat and drink, I will show you some of the amenities of our house." Mrs. Maggs presently returned with a tray, bearing a glass, a small flacon of red wine, and a roll of bread. She set it down on a table at the director's side and left the room. "You see," said the director, "I live like the king in Kurdi. It is a surprisingly pleasant diet." With these words he broke the bread and poured himself out a glass of wine.
"I never read the book you are speaking of," said Jane.
They talked of the book a little while the director ate and drank, but presently he took up the plate and tipped the crumbs off onto the floor. "Now, Mrs. Studdock," he said, "you shall see a diversion, but you must be perfectly still." With these words he took from his pocket a little silver whistle and blew a note on it. And Jane sat still till the room became filled with silence like a solid thing, and there was first a scratching and then a rustling, and presently she saw three plump mice working their passage across what was to them the thick undergrowth of the carpet,
nosing this way and that, so that if their course had been drawn, it would have resembled that of a winding river, until they were so close that she could see the twinkling of their eyes and even the palpitation of their noses. In spite of what she had said, she did not really care for mice in the neighbourhood of her feet, and it was with an effort that she sat still. Thanks to this effort, she saw mice for the first time as they really are, not as creeping things, but as dainty quadrupeds, almost, when they sat up, like tiny kangaroos, with sensitive, kid-gloved forepaws and transparent ears. With quick, inaudible movements, they ranged to and fro till not a crumb was left on the floor. Then he blew a second time on his whistle, and with a sudden whisk of tails, all three of them were racing for home, and in a few seconds had disappeared behind the coal box. The director looked at her with laughter in his eyes. "It is impossible," thought Jane, "to regard him as old." "There," he said, "a very simple adjustment. Humans want crumbs removed, mice are anxious to remove them. It ought never to have been a cause of war. But you see that obedience and rule are more like a dance than a drill, especially between man and woman, where the roles are always changing."
"How huge we must seem to them," said Jane.
This inconsequent remark had a very curious cause. Hugeness was what she was thinking of, and for one moment it had seemed she was thinking of her own hugeness in comparison with the mice. But almost at once this identification collapsed. She was really thinking simply of hugeness. Or rather, she was not thinking of it. She was, in some strange fashion, experiencing it. Something intolerably big, something from Brobdingnag, was pressing on her, was approaching, was almost in the room. She felt herself shrinking, suffocated, emptied of all power and virtue. She darted a glance at the director, which was really a cry for help, and that glance, in some inexplicable way, revealed him as being, like herself, a very small object. The whole room was a tiny place, a mouse's hole, and it seemed to her to be tilted aslant, as though the insupportable mass and splendour of this formless hugeness in approaching had knocked it askew. She heard the director's voice. "Quick," he said gently, "you must leave me now. This is no place for us small ones, but I am inured. Go." 3. When Jane left the hilltop village of St. Anne's and came down to the station, she found that, even down there, the fog had begun to lift. Great windows had opened in it, and as the train carried her on, it passed repeatedly through pools of afternoon sunlight. During this journey, she was so divided against herself that one might say there were three, if not four, Janes in the compartment. The first was a Jane simply receptive of the director, recalling every word and every look, and delighting in them. A Jane taken utterly off her guard, shaken out of the modest little outfit of contemporary ideas which had hitherto made her portion of wisdom, and swept away on the flood tide of an experience which she did not understand and could not control. For she was trying to control it. That was the function of the second Jane. This second Jane regarded the first with disgust, as the kind of woman, in fact, whom she had always particularly despised. Once, coming out of a cinema, she had heard a little shop girl say to her friend, "Oh, wasn't he lovely? If he'd looked at me the way he looked at her, I'd have followed him to the end of the world." A little tawdry, made-up girl sucking a peppermint. Whether the second Jane was right in equating the first Jane with that girl may be questioned, but she did, and she found her intolerable. To have surrendered without terms at the mere voice and look of this stranger, to have abandoned, without noticing it, that prim little grasp on her own destiny, that perpetual reservation which she thought essential to her status as a grown-up, integrated, intelligent person, the thing was utterly degrading, vulgar, uncivilized. The third Jane was a new and unexpected visitant. Of the first there had been traces in girlhood, and the second was what Jane took to be her real or normal self. But the third one, this moral Jane, was one whose existence she had never suspected. Risen from some unknown region of grace or heredity, it uttered all sorts of things which Jane had often heard before, but which had never, till that moment, seemed to be connected with real life. If it had simply told her that her feelings about the director were wrong, she would not have been very surprised, and would have discounted it as the voice of tradition. But it did not. It kept on blaming her for not having similar feelings about Mark. It kept on pressing into her mind those new feelings about Mark, feelings of guilt and pity which she had first experienced in the director's room. It was Mark who had made the fatal mistake. She must be nice to Mark. The director obviously insisted on it. At the very moment when her mind was most filled with another man, there arose, clouded with some undefined emotion, a resolution to give Mark much more than she had ever given him before, and a feeling that in doing so she would be really giving it to the director. And this produced in her such a confusion of sensations that the whole inner debate became indistinct and flowed over into the larger experience of the fourth Jane, who was Jane herself and dominated all the rest at every moment without effort and even without choice. This fourth and supreme Jane was simply in the state of joy. The other three had no power upon her, for she was in the sphere of Jove, amid light and music and festal pomp, brimmed with life and radiant in health, jocund and clothed in shining garments. She thought scarcely at all of the curious sensations which had immediately preceded the director's dismissal of her, and made that dismissal almost a relief. When she tried to, it immediately led her thoughts back to the director himself. Whatever she tried to think of led back to the director himself, and, in him, to joy. She saw from the windows of the train the outlined beams of sunlight pouring over stubble or burnished woods, and felt that they were like the notes of a trumpet. Her eyes rested on the rabbits and cows as they flitted by, and she embraced them in heart with merry holiday love. She delighted in the occasional speech of the one wizened old man who shared her compartment, and saw, as never before, the beauty of his shrewd and sunny old mind, sweet as a nut and English as a chalk down. She reflected with surprise how long it was since music had played any part in her life, and resolved to listen to many chorales by Bach on the gramophone that evening. Or else, perhaps, she would read a great many Shakespeare sonnets. She rejoiced also in her hunger and thirst, and decided that she would make herself buttered toast for tea, a great deal of buttered toast. And she rejoiced also in the consciousness of her own beauty, for she had the sensation, it may have been false in fact, but it had nothing to do with vanity, that it was growing and expanding like a magic flower with every minute that passed. In such a mood, it was only natural, after the old countryman had got out at Cure Hardy, to stand up and look at herself in the mirror which confronted her on the wall of the compartment. Certainly she was looking well. She was looking unusually well. And, once more, there was little vanity in this, for beauty was made for others. Her beauty belonged to the director. It belonged to him so completely that he could even decide not to keep it for himself, but to order that it be given to another, by an act of obedience lower, and therefore higher, more unconditional, and therefore more delighting, than if he had demanded it for himself. As the train came into Edgestow Station, Jane was just deciding that she would not try to get a bus. She would enjoy the walk up to Sandown. And then, what on earth was all this? The platform, usually almost deserted at this hour, was like a London platform on a bank holiday. "Here you are, mate," cried a voice as she opened the door, and half a dozen men crowded into her carriage so roughly that for a moment she could not get out. She found difficulty in crossing the platform. People seemed to be going in all directions at once, angry, rough, and excited people. "Get back into the train, quick," shouted someone. "Get out of the station if you're not travelling," bawled another voice. "What the devil?" asked a third just beside her. And then a woman's voice said, oh dear, why don't they stop it?" And from outside, beyond the station, came a great roaring noise like the noise of a football crowd. There seemed to be a lot of unfamiliar lights about. Hours later, bruised, frightened, and tired to death, Jane found herself in a street she did not even know, surrounded by NICE policemen and a few of their females, the Wapes. Her course had been like that of a man trying to get home along the beach when the tide is coming in. She had been driven out of her natural route along Warwick Street. They were looting shops and making bonfires there, and forced to take a much wider circle up by the asylum, which would have brought her home in the end. Then even that wider circle had proved impracticable, for the same reason. She had been forced to try a still longer way round, and each time the tide had got there before her. Finally she had seen Bone Lane, straight and empty and still, and apparently her last chance of getting home that night at all. A couple of NICE police, one seemed to meet them everywhere except where the rioting was most violent, had shouted out, "You can't go down there, miss." But as they then turned their backs on her, and it was poorly lit, and because she was now desperate, Jane had made a bolt for it. They caught her. and that was how she found herself being taken into a lighted room and questioned by a uniformed woman with short grey hair, a square face, and an unlighted cheroot. The room was in disorder, as if a private house had been suddenly and roughly converted into a temporary police station. The woman with the cheroot took no particular interest until Jane had given her name. Then Miss Hardcastle looked her in the face for the first time, and Jane felt quite a new sensation. She was already tired and frightened, but this was different. The face of the other woman affected her as the face of some men, fat men with small, greedy eyes and strange, disquieting smiles, had affected her when she was in her teens. It was dreadfully quiet, and yet dreadfully interested in her. And Jane saw that some quite new idea was dawning on the woman as she stared at her, some idea that the woman found attractive, then tried to put aside, and then returned to dally with, and then finally, with a little sigh of contentment, accepted. Miss Hardcastle lit her cheroot and blew a cloud of smoke towards her. If Jane had known how seldom Miss Hardcastle actually smoked, she would have been even more alarmed. The policemen and policewomen who surrounded her probably did. The whole atmosphere of the room became a little different.
"Jane Studdock," said the fairy. "I know all about you, honey. You'll be the wife of my friend Mark."
While she spoke, she was writing something on a green form.
"That's all right," said Miss Hardcastle. "You'll be able to see hubby again now. We'll take you out to Belbury tonight. Now just one question, dear. What were you doing down here at this time of night?"
"I had just come off a train."
"And where had you been, honey?"
Jane said nothing.
"You hadn't been getting up to mischief while hubby was away, had you?"
"Will you please let me go?" said Jane. "I want to get home. I am very tired, and it's very late."
"But you're not going home," said Miss Hardcastle. "You're coming out to Belbury."
"My husband has said nothing about my joining him there."
Miss Hardcastle nodded. "That was one of his mistakes. But you're coming with us."
"What do you mean?"
"It's an arrest, honey," said Miss Hardcastle, holding out the piece of green paper on which she had been writing.
It appeared to Jane, as all official forms always appeared, a mass of compartments, some empty, some full of small print, some scrawled with signatures in pencil, and one bearing her own name, all meaningless.
"Oh!"
screamed Jane suddenly, overcome with a sensation of nightmare, and made a dash for the door. Of course she never reached it. A moment later she came to her senses and found herself held by the two policewomen.
"What a naughty temper," said Miss Hardcastle playfully. "But we'll put the nasty men outside, shall we?"
She said something, and the policemen removed themselves and shut the door behind them. As soon as they were gone, Jane felt that a protection had been withdrawn from her.
"Well," said Miss Hardcastle, addressing the two uniformed girls, "let's see. 1:15, and all going nicely. I think, Daisy, we can afford ourselves a little stand easy. Be careful, Kitty. Make your top grip under her shoulder just a little tighter. That's right."
While she was speaking, Miss Hardcastle was undoing her belt, and when she had finished, she removed her tunic and flung it on the sofa, revealing a huge torso, uncorseted, as Bill the Blizzard had complained, rank, floppy, and thinly clad, such things as Rubens might have painted in delirium. Then she resumed her seat, removed the cheroot from her mouth, blew another cloud of smoke in Jane's direction, and addressed her.
"Where had you been by that train?" she said.
And Jane said nothing, partly because she could not speak, and partly because she knew now beyond all doubt that these were the enemies of the human race whom the director was fighting against, and one must tell them nothing. She did not feel heroic in making this decision. The whole scene was becoming unreal to her, and it was as if between sleeping and waking that she heard Miss Hardcastle say,
"I think, Kitty dear, you and Daisy had better bring her round here."
And it was still only half real when the two women forced her round to the other side of the table, and she saw Miss Hardcastle sitting with her legs wide apart and settling herself in the chair as if in the saddle, long, leather-clad legs projecting from beneath her short skirt. The women forced her on with a skilled, quiet increase of pressure whenever she resisted, until she stood between Miss Hardcastle's feet, whereupon Miss Hardcastle brought her feet together so that she had Jane's ankles pinioned between her own. This proximity to the ogress affected Jane with such horror that she had no fears left for what they might be going to do with her. And for what seemed an endless time, Miss Hardcastle stared at her, smiling a little and blowing smoke in her face.
"Do you know," said Miss Hardcastle at last, "you're rather a pretty little thing in your way."
There was another silence.
"Where had you been by that train?" said Miss Hardcastle.
And Jane stared as if her eyes would start out of her head, and said nothing. Then suddenly Miss Hardcastle leant forward, and, after very carefully turning down the edge of Jane's dress, thrust the lighted end of the cheroot against her shoulder. After that there was another pause and another silence.
"Where had you been by that train?" said Miss Hardcastle. How many times this happened Jane could never remember, but somehow or other there came a time when Miss Hardcastle was talking not to her, but to one of the women. "What are you fussing about, Daisy?" she was saying.
"I was only saying, ma'am, it was 1:05.
"How time flies, doesn't it, Daisy? But what if it is? Aren't you comfortable, Daisy? You're not getting tired holding a little bit of a thing like her."
"Oh, no, ma'am, thank you. But you did say, ma'am, you'd meet Captain O'Hara of 1 Sharp.
"Captain O'Hara?" said Miss Castle, dreamily at first, and then louder, like one waking from a dream. Next moment she had jumped up and was putting on her tunic. "Bless the girl," she said. "What a pair of blockheads you are. Why didn't you remind me before?"
"Well, ma'am, I didn't exactly like to."
"Like to? What do you think you're there for?"
"Well, you don't like us to interrupt, ma'am, sometimes, when you're examining," said the girl sulkily.
"Don't argue," shouted Miss Hardcastle, wheeling round and hitting her cheek a resounding blow with the palm of her hand. "Look sharp. Get the prisoner into the car. Don't wait to button up her dress, idiots. I'll be after you the moment I've dipped my face in cold water." A few seconds later, pinioned between Daisy and Kitty, but still close to Miss Hardcastle, there seemed to be room for 5 in the back of the car, Jane found herself gliding through the darkness. "Better go through the town as little as possible, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle's voice. "It'll be pretty lively by now. Go on to the asylum and work down those little streets at the back of the close." There seemed to be all sorts of strange noises and lights about. At places, too, there seemed to be a great many people. Then there came a moment when Jane found that the car had drawn up. "What the hell are you stopping for?" said Miss Hardcastle. For a second or two there was no answer from the driver except grunts and the noise of unsuccessful attempts to start up the engine. "What's the matter?" repeated Miss Hardcastle sharply.
"Dunno, ma'am," said the driver, still working away.
"God," said Miss Hardcastle, "can't you even look after a car? Some of you people want a little humane remedial treatment yourselves."
The street in which they were was empty, but, to judge by the noise, it was near some other street which was very full and very angry. The man got out, swearing under his breath, and opened the bonnet of the car.
"Here," said Miss Hardcastle, "you two hop out. Look round for another car, anywhere within 5 minutes' walk. Commandeer it. If you don't find one, be back here in 10 minutes, whatever happens. Sharp!"
The other two policemen alighted and disappeared at the double. Miss Hardcastle continued pouring abuse on the driver, and the driver continued working at the engine. The noise grew louder. Suddenly the driver straightened himself and turned his face. Jane saw the sweat shining on it in the lamplight towards Miss Hardcastle.
"Look here, miss," he said. "That's about enough, see? You keep a civil tongue in your head, or else come and mend a bloody car yourself if you're so bloody clever."
"Don't you try taking that line with me, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle, "or you'll find me saying a little word about you to the ordinary police."
"Well, suppose you do," said Joe. "I'm beginning to think I might as well be in clinkers in your bucking tea party. Struce, I've been in the military police, and I've been in the black and tans, and I've been in the BUF, but they were all ruddy picnics to this lot. A man got some decent treatment there, and he had men over him, not a bloody lot of old women."
"Yes, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle, "but it wouldn't be clink for you this time if I passed the word to the ordinary cops."
"Oh, it wouldn't it? I might have a story or two to tell about yourself if it came to that."
"For the Lord's sake, speak to him nicely, ma'am," wailed Kitty. "They're coming. We'll catch it proper."
And in fact, men running by twos and threes had begun to trickle into the street.
"Foot it, girls," said Miss Hardcastle. "Sharp's the word. This way."
Jane found herself hustled out of the car and hurried along between Daisy and Kitty. Miss Hardcastle moved in front. The little party darted across the street and up an alley on the far side.
"Any of you know the way here?" asked Miss Hardcastle, when they had walked a few steps.
"Don't know, I'm sure, ma'am," said Daisy. "I'm a stranger here myself, ma'am," said Kitty.
"Nice useful lot I've got," said Miss Hardcastle. "Is there anything you do know?"
"It doesn't seem to go no further, ma'am," said Kitty.
The alley had indeed turned out to be a dead end. Miss Hardcastle stood still for a moment. Unlike her subordinates, she did not seem to be frightened, but only pleasantly excited, and rather amused at the white faces and shaky voices of the girls.
"Well," she said, "this is what I call a night out. You're seeing life, Daisy, aren't you? I wonder, are any of these houses empty? All locked, anyway. Perhaps we'd best stay where we are."
The shouting in the street they had left had grown louder, and they could see a confused mass of humanity surging vaguely in a westward direction. Suddenly it became much louder still and angrier. "They've caught Joe," said Miss Hardcastle. "If he can make himself heard, he'll send them up here. Blast! This means losing the prisoner. Oh, stop blubbering, Daisy, you little fool. Quick, we must go down into the crowd separately. We've a very good chance of getting through. Keep your heads. Don't shoot, whatever you do. Try to get to Billingham at the crossroads. Ta-ta, Babs. The quieter you keep, the less likely we are to meet again." Miss Hardcastle set off at once. Jane saw her stand for a few seconds on the fringes of the crowd and then disappear into it. The two girls hesitated and then followed. Jane sat down on a doorstep. The burns were painful where her dress had rubbed against them, but what chiefly troubled her was extreme weariness. She was also deadly cold and a little sick, but above all tired. So tired she could drop asleep almost. She shook herself. There was complete silence all about her. She was colder than she had ever been before, and her limbs ached. "I believe I have been asleep," she thought. She rose, stretched herself, and walked down the desolate lamplit alley into the larger street. It was quite empty, except for one man in a railway uniform who said, "Good morning, miss," as he walked smartly past. She stood for a moment, undecided, and then began to walk slowly to her right. She put her hand in the pocket of the coat which Daisy and Kitty had flung round her before leaving the flat, and found 3/4 of a large slab of chocolate. She was ravenous, and began munching it. Just as she finished, she was overtaken by a car, which drew up shortly after it had passed her.
"Are you all right?" said a man, poking his head out.
"Were you hurt in the riot?" said a woman's voice from within. "No, not much. I don't know," said Jane stupidly. The man stared at her and then got out.
"I say," he said, "you don't look too good. Are you sure you're quite well?"
Then he turned and spoke to the woman inside. It seemed so long to Jane since she had heard kind or even sane voices that she felt like crying. The unknown couple made her sit in the car and gave her brandy and after that sandwiches. Finally, they asked if they could give her a lift home. Where was home? And Jane, somewhat to her surprise, heard her own voice very sleepily answering, "The Manor at St. Anne's."
"Well, that's fine," said the man. "We're making for Birmingham, and we have to pass it."
Then Jane fell asleep at once again, and awoke only to find herself entering a lighted doorway and being received by a woman in pyjamas and an overcoat who turned out to be Mrs. Maggs. But she was too tired to remember how or where she got to bed. Chapter 8. Moonlight at Belbury. 1.
"I am the last person, Miss Hardcastle," said the deputy director, "to wish to interfere with your, private pleasures. But really—"
It was some hours before breakfast time, and the old gentleman was fully dressed and unshaved. But if he had been up all night, it was odd that he had let his fire out. He and the fairy were standing by a cold and blackened grate in his study.
"She can't be far away," said Fairy Hardcastle. "We'll pick her up some other time. It was well worth trying. If I'd got out of her where she'd been, and I should have got it if I'd had a few minutes longer, why, it might have turned out to be enemy headquarters. We might have rounded up the whole gang."
"It was hardly a suitable occasion," began Wither, but she interrupted him.
"We haven't so much time to waste, you know. You tell me Frost is already complaining that the woman's mind is less accessible. And according to your own metapsychology, or whatever you call the damned jargon, that means she's falling under the influence of the other side. You told me that yourself. Where'll we be if you lose touch with her mind before I've got her body locked up here?"
"'I am always, of course,' said Wither, "'most ready and interested to hear expressions of your own opinions, "'and would not for a moment deny that they are, "'in certain respects, of course, if not in all, "'of a very real value. "'On the other hand, there are matters on which your necessarily specialized experience "'does not entirely qualify you. "'An arrest was not contemplated at this stage. "'The head will, I fear, take the view that you have exceeded your authority.' "'Trespassed beyond your proper sphere, Miss Hardcastle. "'I do not say that I necessarily agree with him, "'but we must all agree that unauthorized action—' "'Oh, cut it out, Wither,' said the fairy, "'seating herself on the side of the table. "'Try that game on the steels and stones. "'I know too much about it. "'It's no bloody good trying the elasticity stunt on me. "'It was a golden opportunity running into that girl. "'If I hadn't taken it, you'd have talked about lack of initiative. "'As I did, you talk about exceeding my authority.' You can't frighten me. I know bloody well we're all for it if the NICE fails, and in the meantime I'd like to see you do without me. We've got to get the girl, haven't we? But not by an arrest. We have always deprecated anything like violence. If a mere arrest could have secured the goodwill and collaboration of Mrs. Studdock, we should hardly have embarrassed ourselves with the presence of her husband. And even supposing— "'merely, of course, for the purpose of argument, "'that your action in arresting her could be justified. "'I am afraid your conduct of the affair after that "'is open to serious criticism.' "'Well, I couldn't tell that the bucking car "'was going to break down, could I?' "'I do not think,' said Wither, "'the head could be induced to regard that "'as the only miscarriage. "'Once the slightest resistance on this woman's part developed, "'it was not, in my opinion, "'reasonable to expect success by the method you employed.' As you are aware, I always deplore anything that is not perfectly humane. But that is quite consistent with the position that if more drastic expedients have to be used, then they must be used thoroughly. Moderate pain, such as any ordinary degree of endurance can resist, is always a mistake. It is no true kindness to the prisoner. The more scientific and, may I add, more civilized facilities for coercive examination which we have placed at your disposal here might have been successful. I am not speaking officially, Miss Hardcastle, and I would not in any sense attempt to anticipate the reactions of our head, but I should not be doing my duty if I failed to remind you that complaints from that quarter have already been made, though not, of course, minuted, as to your tendency to allow a certain emotional excitement in the disciplinary or remedial side of your work to distract you from the demands of policy. You won't find anyone can do a job like mine well unless they get some kick out of it. "'Said the fairy, sulkily. "'The deputy director looked at his watch. "'Anyway,' said the fairy, "'what does the head want to see me now for? "'I've been on my feet the whole bloody night. "'I might be allowed a bath and some breakfast.' "'The path of duty, Miss Hardcastle,' said Wither, "'can never be an easy one. "'You will not forget that punctuality is one of the points "'on which emphasis has sometimes been laid.' "'Miss Hardcastle got up and rubbed her face with her hands. "'Well, I must have something to drink before I go in.' she said. Wither held out his hands in deprecation. "'Oh, come on, Wither, I must,' said Miss Hardcastle. "'You don't think he'll smell it?' said Wither. "'I'm not going in without it anyway,' said she. The old man unlocked his cupboard and gave her whiskey. Then the two left the study and went a long way, right over to the other side of the house, where it joined on to the actual blood transfusion offices. It was all dark at this hour in the morning, and they went by the light of Miss Hardcastle's torch, on through carpeted and pictured passages into blank passages with rubberoid floors and distempered walls, and then through a door they had to unlock, and then through another. All the way Miss Hardcastle's booted feet made a noise, but the slippered feet of the deputy director made no noise at all. At last they came to a place where the lights were on, and there was a mixture of animal and chemical smells, and then to a door, which was open to them after they had parleyed through a speaking tube. Philostrato, wearing a white coat, confronted them in the doorway. "Enter," said Philostrato. "He expects you for some time." "Is it in a bad temper?" said Miss Hardcastle.
"Shh," said Wither. "And in any case, my dear lady, I don't think that is quite the way in which one should speak of our head, his sufferings, in his peculiar condition, you know."
"You are to go in at once," said Philostrato, "as soon as you have made yourselves ready."
"Stop, half a moment," said Miss Hardcastle suddenly.
"What is it? Be quick, please," said Philostrato. "I'm going to be sick. You cannot be sick here. Go back. I will give you some X-54 at once.
It's all right now, said Miss Hardcastle. It was only momentary. It'll take more than this to upset me.
Silence, please, said the Italian. Do not attempt to open the second door until my assistant has shut the first one behind you. Do not speak any more than you can help. Do not even say yes when you are given an order. The head will assume your obedience. Do not make sudden movements. Do not get too close. Do not shout. And above all, do not argue. Now.
2. Long after sunrise, there came into Jane's sleeping mind a sensation which, had she put it into words, would have sung, Be glad, thou sleeper, and thy sorrow offcast. I am the gate to all good adventure. And after she had wakened and found herself lying in pleasant languor with winter morning sunlight falling across her bed, the mood continued. He must let me stay here now, she thought. Sometime after this, Mrs. Maggs came in and lit the fire and brought the breakfast. Jane winced as she sat up in bed, for some of the burns had stuck to the strange nightdress, rather too large for her, in which she found herself clad. There was an indefinable difference in Mrs. Maggs' behaviour. "It's ever so nice us both being here, isn't it, Mrs. Studdock?" she said, and somehow the tone seemed to imply a closer relation than Jane had envisaged between them. But she was too lazy to wonder much about it. Shortly after breakfast came Miss Ironwood. She examined and dressed the burns, which were not serious. "You can get up in the afternoon, if you like, Mrs. Studdock," she said. "I should just take a quiet day till then. What would you like to read? There's a pretty large library."
"I'd like the Curdie books, please," said Jane, and Mansfield Park and Shakespeare's sonnets.
Having thus been provided with reading matter for several hours, she very comfortably went to sleep again. When Mrs. Maggs looked in at about 4 o'clock to see if Jane was awake, Jane said she would like to get up.
"All right, Mrs. Studdock," said Mrs. Maggs, "just as you like. I'll bring you along a nice cup of tea in a minute, and then I'll get the bathroom ready for you. There's a bathroom next door, almost, only I'll have to get that Mr. Bultitude out of it. He's that lazy, and he will go in and sit there all day when it's cold weather."
As soon as Mrs. Maggs had gone, however, Jane decided to get up. She felt that her social abilities were quite equal to dealing with the eccentric Mr. Bultitude, and she did not want to waste any more time in bed. She had an idea that if once she were up and about, all sorts of pleasant and interesting things might happen. Accordingly, she put on her coat, took her towel, and proceeded to explore. And that was why Mrs. Maggs, coming upstairs with tea a moment later, heard a suppressed shriek, and saw Jane emerge from the bathroom with a white face and slam the door behind her.
"Oh, dear," said Mrs. Maggs, bursting into laughter. "I ought to have told you. Oh, never mind. I'll soon have him out of that."
She set the tea tray down on the passage floor and turned to the bathroom.
"Is it safe?" asked Jane.
"Oh, yes, he's safe, all right," said Mrs. Maggs. "But he's not that easy to shift. Not for you or me, Mrs. Studdock. Of course, if it was Miss Ironwood or the director, it would be another matter."
With that, she opened the bathroom door. Inside, sitting up on its hunkers beside the bath and occupying most of the room, was a great, snuffly, wheezy, beady-eyed, loose-skinned, gore-bellied brown bear, which, after a great many reproaches, appeals, exhortations, pushes, and blows from Mrs. Maggs, heaved up its enormous bulk and came very slowly out into the passage.
"Why don't you go out and take some exercise that lovely afternoon, you great lazy thing?" said Mrs. Maggs. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself, sitting there getting in everyone's way."
"Oh, don't be frightened, Mrs. Studdock. He's as tame as tame. He'll let you stroke him. Go on, Mr. Bultitude. Go and say how do you do to the lady."
Jane extended a hesitant and unconvincing hand to touch the animal's back, but Mr. Bultitude was sulking, and without a glance at Jane, continued his slow walk along the passage to a point about 10 yards away, where he suddenly sat down. The tea-things rattled at Jane's feet, and everyone on the floor below must have known that Mr. Bultitude had sat down.
"Is it really safe to have a creature like that loose about the house?" said Jane.
"Mrs. Studdock," said Ivy Maggs with some solemnity, "if the director wanted to have a tiger about the house, it would be safe. That's the way he has with animals. There isn't a creature in the place that would go for another or for us once he's had his little talk with them. Just the same as he does with us, you'll see."
"If you would put the tea in my room," said Jane rather coldly, and went into the bathroom.
"Yes," said Mrs. Maggs, standing in the open doorway. You might have had your bath with Mr. Bultitude sitting there beside you. Though he's that big and that human, I don't somehow feel it would be nice myself. Jane made to shut the door.
Well, I'll leave you to it, then, said Mrs. Maggs, without moving.
Thank you, said Jane.
Sure you got everything you want?
Said Mrs. Maggs.
Quite sure, said Jane.
Well, I'll be getting along, then, said Mrs. Maggs, turning as if to go, but almost instantly turning back again to say, You'll find us in the kitchen, I expect, Mother Dimble and me and the rest.
Is Mrs. Dimble staying in the house?
Asked Jane, with a slight emphasis on the Mrs.
Mother Dimble, we all call her here, said Mrs. Maggs, and I'm sure she won't mind you doing the same.
You'll get used to our ways in a day or two, I'm sure. It's a funny house, really, when you come to think of it.
Well, I'll be getting along, then.
Don't take too long, or your tea won't be worth drinking.
But I dare say you'd better not have a bath, not with those nasty places on your chest.
Got all you want?
When Jane had washed and had tea and dressed herself with as much care as strange hairbrushes and a strange mirror allowed, she set out to look for the inhabited rooms. She passed down one long passage through that silence which is not quite like any other in the world, the silence upstairs in a big house on a winter afternoon. Presently she came to a place where two passages met, and here the silence was broken by a faint, irregular noise. Pop, 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 pop. Looking to her right, she saw the explanation, for where the passage ended in a bay window stood Mr. Bultitude, this time on his hind legs, meditatively boxing a punch-bowl. Jane chose the way to her left, and came to a gallery whence she looked down the staircase into a large hall, where daylight mixed with firelight. On the same level with herself, but only to be reached by descending to a landing and ascending again, were shadowy regions which she recognised as leading to the director's room. A sort of solemnity seemed to her to emanate from them, and she went down into the hall almost on tiptoes. And now, for the first time, her memory of that last and curious experience in the blue room came back to her with a weight which even the thought of the director himself could not counteract. When she reached the hall, she saw at once where the back premises of the house must lie. Down two steps and along a paved passage, past a stuffed pike in a glass case, and then past a grandfather clock, and then, guided by voices and other sounds, to the kitchen itself. A wide, open hearth, glowing with burning wood, lit up the comfortable form of Mrs. Dimble, who was seated in a kitchen chair at one side of it, apparently, from the basin in her lap and other indications on a table beside her, engaged in preparing vegetables. Mrs. Maggs and Camilla were doing something at a stove. The hearth was apparently not used for cooking, and in a doorway which doubtless led to the scullery, a tall, grizzle-headed man who wore gumboots and seemed to have just come in from the garden was drying his hands.
"Oh, come in, Jane," said Mother Dimble cordially. "We're not expecting you to do any work today. Come and sit on the other side of the fire and talk to me. This is Mr. McPhee, who has no right to be here, but he'd better be introduced to you."
Mr. McPhee, having finished the drying process and carefully hung the towel behind the door, advanced rather ceremoniously and shook hands with Jane. His own hand was very large and coarse in texture, and he had a shrewd, hard-featured face.
"I'm very glad to see you, Mrs. Studdock," he said, in what Jane took to be a Scotch accent, though it was really that of an Ulsterman.
"Don't believe a word he says, Jane," said Mother Dimble. "He's your prime enemy in this house. He doesn't believe in your dreams."
"Mrs. Dumble," said McPhee, "I have repeatedly explained to you the distinction between a personal feeling of confidence and a logical satisfaction of the claims of evidence. The one is a psychological event, and the other a perpetual nuisance," said Mrs. Dimble.
"Never mind her, Mrs. Studdock," said McPhee. "I am, as I was saying, very glad to welcome you among us. The fact that I have found it my duty on several occasions to point out that no experimentum crucis has yet confirmed the hypothesis that your dreams are veridical has no connection in the world with my personal attitude."
"Of course," said Jane vaguely and a little confused. "I'm sure you have a right to your own opinions."
All the women laughed as McPhee, in a somewhat louder tone, replied, "Mrs. Studdock, I have no opinions on any subject in the world. I state the facts and exhibit the implications. If everyone indulged in fewer opinions," he pronounced the word with emphatic disgust, "there'd be less silly talking and printing in the world."
"I know who talks most in this house," said Mrs. Maggs, somewhat to Jane's surprise.
The Ulsterman eyed the last speaker with an unaltered face while producing a small pewter box from his pocket and helping himself to a pinch of snuff.
"What are you waiting for, anyway?" said Mrs. Maggs. "Women's Day in the kitchen today."
"I was wondering," said McPhee, "whether you had a cup of tea saved for me."
"And why didn't you come in at the right time, then?"
said Mrs. Maggs. Jane noticed that she talked to him much as she talked to the bear.
"I was busy,"
said the other, seating himself at one end of the table, and added, after a pause, "Trenching celery. The wee woman does the best she can, but she has a poor notion of what needs doing in a garden."
"What is Women's Day in the kitchen?"
asked Jane of Mother Dimble.
"There are no servants here," said Mother Dimble, "and we all do the work. The women do it one day, and the men the next."
"What?"
"No, it's a very sensible arrangement. The director's idea is that men and women can't do housework together without quarrelling. There's something in it. Of course, it doesn't do to look at the cups too closely on the men's day, but on the whole we get along pretty well."
"But why should they quarrel?" asked Jane.
"Different methods, my dear. Men can't help in a job, you know. They can be induced to do it, not to help while you're doing it. At least, it makes them grumpy."
"The cardinal difficulty," said McPhee, "in collaboration between the sexes, is that women speak a language without nouns. If two men are doing a bit of work, one will say to the other, 'Put this bowl inside the bigger bowl which you'll find on the top shelf of the green cupboard.' The female for this is, 'Put that in the other one in there.' And then if you ask them, 'In where?' they say, 'In there, of course.' There is consequently a phatic hiatus." He pronounced this so as to rhyme with "get at us."
"There's your tea now," said Ivy Maggs, "and I'll go and get you a piece of cake, which is more than you deserve. And when you've had it, you can go upstairs and talk about nouns for the rest of the evening."
"Not about nouns, by means of nouns," said McPhee. But Mrs. Maggs had already left the room. Jane took advantage of this to say to Mother Dimble in a lower voice,
"Mrs. Maggs seems to make herself very much at home here."
"Oh, my dear, she is at home here."
"As a maid, you mean?"
"Well, no more than anyone else. She's here chiefly because her house has been taken from her. She had nowhere else to go."
"You mean she is one of the director's charities?"
"Well, certainly that. Why do you ask?"
"Well, I don't know. It did seem a little odd that she should call you Mother Dimble. I hope I'm not being snobbish."
"Oh, you're forgetting that Cecil and I are another of the director's charities."
"Isn't that rather playing on words?"
"Well, not a bit. Ivy and Cecil and I are all here because we were turned out of our homes. At least Ivy and I are. It may be rather different for Cecil."
"And does the director know that Mrs. Maggs talks to everyone like that?"
"Oh, my dear child, don't ask me what the director knows. I think what's puzzling me is that when I saw him he said something about equality not being the important thing. But his own house seems to be run on, well, on very democratic lines indeed."
"I never attempt to understand what he says on that subject," said Mother Dimble. "He's usually talking either about spiritual ranks, and you were never goose enough to think yourself spiritually superior to Ivy, or else he's talking about marriage."
"Did you understand his views on marriage?"
"My dear, the director is a very wise man, but he is a man, after all, and an unmarried man at that. Some of what he says, or what the masters say about marriage, does seem to me to be a lot of fuss about something so simple and natural that it oughtn't to need saying at all. But I suppose there are young women nowadays who need to be told it."
"You haven't got much use for young women who do, I see."
"Well, perhaps I'm unfair. Things were easier for us. We were brought up on stories with happy endings and on the prayer book. We always intended to love, honour, and obey, and we had figures, and we wore petticoats, and we liked waltzes."
"Waltzes are ever so nice," said Mrs. Maggs, who had just returned and given McPhee his slab of cake. "So old-fashioned." At that moment the door opened, and a voice from behind it said, "Well, go in, then, if you're going." Thus admonished, a very fine jackdaw hopped into the room, followed firstly by Mr. Bultitude and secondly by Arthur Denniston.
"I've told you before, Arthur," said Ivy Maggs, "not to bring that bear in here when we're cooking the dinner."
While she was speaking, Mr. Bultitude, who was apparently himself uncertain of his welcome, walked across the room in what he believed, erroneously, to be an unobtrusive manner, and sat down behind Mrs. Dimble's chair.
"Dr. Dimble's just come back, Mother Dimble," said Denniston,
"but he's had to go straight to the blue room. And the director wants you to go to him too, McPhee."
3.
Mark sat down to lunch that day in good spirits. Everyone reported that the riot had gone off most satisfactorily, and he had enjoyed reading his own accounts of it in the morning papers. He enjoyed it even more when he heard Steele and Kosser talking about it in a way which showed that they did not even know how it had been engineered, much less who had written it up in the newspapers. And he had enjoyed his morning, too. It had involved a conversation with Frost, the fairy, and Wither himself about the future of Edgestow. All were agreed that the government would follow the almost unanimous opinion of the nation, as expressed in the newspapers, and put it temporarily under the control of the institutional police. An emergency governor of Edgestow must be appointed. Featherstone was the obvious man. As a member of Parliament, he represented the nation. As a fellow of Bracton, he represented the university. As a member of the Institute, he represented the Institute. All the competing claims that might otherwise have come into collision were reconciled in the person of Lord Featherstone. The articles on this subject, which Mark was to write that afternoon, would almost write themselves. But that had not been all. As the conversation proceeded, it had become clear that there was really a double object in getting this invidious post for Featherstone. When the time came and the local unpopularity of the NICE rose to its height, he could be sacrificed. This, of course, was not said in so many words, but Mark realized perfectly clearly that even Featherstone was no longer quite in the inner ring. The fairy said that old Dick was a mere politician at heart and always would be. Wither, deeply sighing, confessed that his talents had been perhaps more useful at an earlier stage of the movement than they were likely to be in the period on which they were now entering. There was in Mark's mind no plan for undermining Featherstone, nor even a fully formed wish that he should be undermined. But the whole atmosphere of the discussion became somehow more agreeable to him as he began to understand the real situation. He was also pleased that he had, as he would have put it, got to know Frost. He knew by experience that there is in almost every organization some quiet, inconspicuous person whom the small fry suppose to be of no importance, but who is really one of the mainsprings of the whole machine. Even to recognize such people for what they are shows that one had made considerable progress. There was, to be sure, a cold, fish-like quality about Frost which Mark did not like, and something even repulsive about the regularity of his features. But every word he spoke, he did not speak many, went to the root of what was being discussed, and Mark found it delightful to speak to him. The pleasures of conversation were coming for Mark to have less and less connection with his spontaneous liking or disliking of the people he talked to. He was aware of this change, which had begun when he joined the progressive element in college, and welcomed it as a sign of maturity. Wither had thawed in a most encouraging manner. At the end of the conversation, he had taken Mark aside, spoken vaguely but paternally of the great work he was doing, and finally asked after his wife. The DD hoped there was no truth in the rumour which had reached him that she was suffering from some nervous disorder. "Who the devil has been telling him that?" thought Mark. "Because," said Wither, "it had occurred to me, in view of the great pressure of work which rests on you at present, and the difficulty, therefore, of your being home as much as we should all, for your sake, wish, that in your case the Institute might be induced—I am speaking in a quite informal way—that we should all be delighted to welcome Mrs. Studdock here." Until the DD had said this, Mark had not realized that there was nothing he would dislike so much as having Jane at Belbury. There were so many things that Jane would not understand. Not only the pretty heavy drinking which was becoming his habit, but, oh, everything from morning to night. For it is only justice both to Mark and to Jane to record that he would have found it impossible to conduct in her hearing any one of the 100 conversations which his life at Belbury involved. Her mere presence would have made all the laughter of the inner ring sound metallic, unreal, and what he now regarded as common prudence would seem to her, and through her to himself, mere flattery, backbiting, and toad-eating. Jane in the middle of Belbury would turn the whole of Belbury into a vast vulgarity, flashy and yet furtive. His mind sickened at the thought of trying to teach Jane that she must help to keep Wither in a good temper, and must play up to Fairy Hardcastle. He excused himself vaguely to the DD with profuse thanks, and got away as quickly as he could. That afternoon, while he was having tea, Fairy Hardcastle came and leaned over the back of his chair and said in his ear, "You've torn it, Studdock." "What's the matter now, Fairy?" said he. "I can't make out what's the matter with you, young Studdock, and that's a fact. Have you made up your mind to annoy the old man? Because it's a dangerous game, you know."
What on earth are you talking about?
Well, here we've all been working on your behalf and soothing him down, and this morning we thought we'd finally succeeded. He was talking about giving you the appointment originally intended for you and waiving the probationary period. Not a cloud in the sky. And then you have 5 minutes chat with him, barely 5 minutes, in fact, and in that time you've managed to undo it all. I begin to think you're mental.
What the devil's wrong with him this time?
Well, you ought to know. Didn't he say something about bringing your wife here?
Oh, yes, he did. What about it?
And what did you say?
Well, I said not to bother about it, and of course thanked him very much and all that.
The fairy whistled.
Don't you see, honey, she said, gently rapping Mark's scalp with her knuckles, that you can hardly have made a worse bloomer? It was a most terrific concession for him to make. He's never done it to anyone else. You might have known he'd be offended if you cold-shouldered him. He's burbling away now about lack of confidence, says he's hurt, which means that somebody else soon will be. He'll take your refusal as a sign that you're not really settled here.
But that is sheer madness. I mean, why the blazes couldn't you tell him you'd have your wife here?
Well, isn't that my own business?
Don't you want to have her? You're not very polite to little wifey, Studdock, and they tell me she's a damned pretty girl.
At that moment the form of Wither, slowly sauntering in their direction, became apparent,